Good morning. Presenters Ryan Tuberty and Ray Darcy were contending with cruelty of all kinds this week. First up, Ryan, and some very angry birds.
Yesterday morning at about 6:45, there was a pigeon. It looked a bit out of sorts, wandering around. I went up quite close to it and it was just kind of flapping around, like dazed, like it had a few drinks. So I said, okay, well, this is kind of a cute little image. I'll record a little bit of the bird wandering around, going, whoo, you know, a bit jarred, just doing its thing. And I put it up on Instagram and said, look, everybody, look. Yeah, it's a cry for attention. But I put it up and said, look at this poor bird. 5 minutes later, I'm looking out the window to see how's he doing, the poor creature. It was eviscerated by two crows with its head chopped off and probably eaten. I couldn't believe it. There are two jackdaw crows hanging around the drain pipes. They look like baddies in a movie. If you could tattoo a crow, they look like, and I'm not anti-tattoos, you know what I mean? But I just, if they had these kind of military ones, not the nice ones most people have. Do you know what it looked like? It was pumped up on steroids. It looked like a crow that goes to the gym, pumped up on steroids, and probably does illegal stuff. It was vicious. The feathers everywhere, headless pigeon. So look, if you think you're having a bad day today, at least you're not a headless, eviscerated pigeon in my backyard. There could be worse things that could happen to you.
Like a packet of Tato and a mashed up banana. Step up, Darcy.
Shaking some crushed up crisps onto the thing. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm not looking forward to this. Here goes. No, is all I can say. No. No, no. Wrong on so many levels. No, no, no. No.
Toasted, maybe?
No.
Salt and vinegar, then?
No.
Fussy. But he did divulge one culinary weakness to Conor Pope, who just laughed in his face.
As a treat on a Sunday afternoon, I used to get a bag of crisps and cut up a pear and put them in a bowl together. That was my treat.
It's like something from Angela's Ashes, really, isn't it? A bag of crisps and a pear. And did you get an orange off Santa Claus, Ray?
No. A piece of coal. That's what I got.
Ray Darcy, possibly the only Kildare man who might be missing a little bit of lockdown. And we're starting playback this week on a fairly light note because after all the drama of the past few weeks politically, it's been fairly quiet. However, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle that broke on Thursday evening when new guidelines were released saying pubs and restaurants serving food needed to keep a record of individual food orders for 28 days. Take that, banana and crisp sandwich. Well, bar owner Noel Anderson and incoming chair of the Licensed Vintners Association spoke to Mary Wilson.
Noel, to ask the stupid question maybe, why are they expecting you to keep all this information for 28 days?
I don't know. I mean, at this age, if you didn't laugh, you'd just start crying because, like, it's just one thing after another after another. We can only imagine that they're just trying to tee it up for with the Garda powers that are coming in. But, I mean, for me, this is just a step too far. It's actually gone farcical. I mean, I told my wife about it in the car when she was coming home. And she started laughing. She thought I was joking. I said, oh, I'm actually serious.
And Fianna Fáil TD for Sligo Leitrim, Mark McSharry, was also on the line.
Was it a bit over the top to go in, you know, studs up saying the new rules are Stasi-like?
No, not in my opinion, Mary. Nobody wants to risk anyway the hard fought for gains in the fight against COVID. But to be asking what somebody had for their dinner and put the administrative burden on those pubs and restaurants that are allowed open is just ridiculous and unnecessary nonsense.
Tell us what you really feel. But back to Noel Anderson.
Did you know this was coming?
No, we absolutely called complete bolt out of the blue. We got a one-liner email this morning. Here's, by the way, this is the fifth set of guidelines we've been given since we've opened. I mean, like, you know, we're employing people front of house. Now you need to put employ people back of house to kind of keep a track of all this stuff. Like, you know, it's actually mind-blowing.
Now, to be fair, it transpired that it wasn't exactly to keep track of what you ate per se, burger, chips and taco fries, quite the appetite, but more that you did in fact eat and not split the pizza margarita five ways with 79 pints. Adrian Cummins, CEO of the Restaurants Association of Ireland, spoke to Brian Dobson on Morning Ireland and he felt that what we had here, yet again, was a failure to communicate.
It's doable, but it's more work for the business, and it's more work for a business that is under extreme pressure at the moment, and they're fearing for the businesses. Mm. But we shouldn't be at this situation here today. This should have been communicated after the cabinet meeting on Tuesday when it was signed off. There was no announcement around this on August the 18th around the regulations, the new regulations for six at a table, hand sanitizers. This has come out of the blue. No advance warning to the trade representative bodies like ourselves, no consultation. So we shouldn't be here this morning talking about this. This should be well flagged in advance. And it goes back to communication. Mm. Tell people what you're trying to do, explain to them, and bring the people with you.
Adrian Cummins on Morning Ireland yesterday, and later on the News at One, Richard Downes took Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly to task over the messaging on this.
Do you accept that the confusion and the furore that has risen up about this is because you didn't consult with the representative bodies and key stakeholders, as they say, in advance of this instrument coming into law?
There's a wide group of stakeholders that do need to be engaged with right across government in many different government departments. And of course, if this has upset people, of course, we're never aiming to do that. There are really only two aims of this measure. One is for public safety, and the second is to protect the vast majority of pubs and restaurants who are doing the right thing.
But you didn't consult with them. Was it your fault or is it some other department's fault?
So that's a whole of government job. So all of government needs to consult with their stakeholders. So what happens is the intention to publish the regulations is provided several days ahead of time so that stakeholder engagement can happen. But Richard, can I say, to be fair to my cabinet colleagues, we are living in unprecedented times. We have to move very quickly in response to the virus. And in order to keep people safe and in order to protect the economy and civil liberties, we're having to do things in days that normally governments would take months to do.
You seem to be saying that this is a mistake. You seem to be admitting there that you made a mistake with this.
What I'm saying is that clearly if good people are annoyed and anxious about that, we must always endeavour to communicate with them fully and as quickly as possible.
Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly on yesterday's News at One. Well, one programme this week showing us how to beat the system was A Very Irish Coup from the Dock on One. It told the story from 1978 of the perfectly legal manipulation of a dog race, which saw the bookies, yes, the bookies, being taken to the cleaners. So just how did they win? Well, they spotted a flaw in the system. And it involves something called the tote.
People's bets are placed in a pool, and if your dog wins, you share that pool with the other winners. The tote is a mathematical system. It doesn't ask if the dog is good or bad, has it ever won a race, or even does it have four legs or three. The tote just looks at how much money has been bet on a dog, but this leaves room for manipulation. The fewer bets on your dog, the more you'll get if he wins, because the tote reflects that the dog is unpopular and possibly not very good. That means that if a great dog, even the favourite, was running, and for some illogical reason, only one person decided to bet on him at the racetrack, his odds would be very big, even though he's the most likely to win.
But surely the bookies would be aware of this loophole. Well, yes and no.
It's nearly impossible to trick the bookies. They'll spot a scam a mile off. They're perceptive, clever, sentient beings, although many punters might dispute that. But you can play a mathematical system, such as the tote, by getting it to believe the bookie's favourite is useless and should be very big odds to win. The real stroke is to get the bookies, who are far too shrewd to be manipulated, to put their fate in the tote, which can be manipulated.
Ooh, it's on. Well, they deployed a 60-strong team to go around the country to put on bets and generally cause calculated mayhem. Now, all eyes were on the greyhound.
Everything was dependent on the greyhound Ballydonald Sam winning.
Away they came, the four brigade, well, that's proper blue.
What if the whole thing was up in smoke if he's lost, like? It was raining that night anyway, and Ballydonald was not an early pace dog. He was a dog that he kicked on from about halfway, but he was a great track dog. And he wouldn't cut in at bends or anything else, he'd wait for his turn. But this night he was a bit tardy away anyway. And down the back straight, he was 3 to 4 lengths down, it was only a 600-yard race. And He got a clear run and turned around the last bend. He was still two off. And there's a good long straight in Mullingar. Yeah. But we know like that once halfway up the straight, he was going to win. Like, but he got up to win by half a length going away. Like.
Their dog had won. And Ballydonald Sam won at odds of 945-1 on the tote, a record that stands to this day.
But the bookies, they call fraud.
Now, it was time for the conspirators to collect. The bookmakers who called in the fraud squad did not want to pay out. The money involved was just too big. What would happen when the coup members went to collect their winnings? Spike, who placed a lot of the bets, was first on the road.
I went to Dublin anyway, and I started off in Dunleary, and I was refused payment, and I went to Blackrock, and I was refused payment.
It was to be the same all over the country. The bookies refused to pay up, with a few notable exceptions.
One Cork firm, I'll give them 10 out of 10 anyway, John and Mahanius, they paid the full amount anyway, the 100-1, which was their limit. And we had about £6 on with them, and they paid us the £600.
At the end of the day, a few bookies coughed up, bringing their takings to just £1,200, a far cry from the £400,000 to £600,000 they expected. But it was still enough to cover their outlay. But would there have been an investigation if Ballydonald Sam had lost?
There's an old rule with the bookmakers, thou shalt not win.
The only mistake we made is we hadn't the money to go to the High Court. If we went to the High Court, there's no judge in the world to go against us because we'd done nothing wrong. The trainer didn't know anything about it. The dog didn't know anything about it. The fellas going up backing him didn't know anything about it, but a few of us. We stopped Norman going into the thing. People couldn't get in because we were still putting on bets. There was nothing in the world wrong. It was the most perfect job that was ever pulled off. It was perfect.
Conor Keane with a very Irish coup, the Dock on One. In her new book, More Than a Woman, Caitlin Moran has written about life in her mid-40s, or as she puts it, the hag years.
When I wrote How to Be a Woman, that's about the bit that I thought would be the hardest bit in your life, which is kind of, you know, being a hot mess, trying to work out who you are, you know, difficult teenage years and stuff. And I genuinely thought my middle age would be a time of elegance and relaxation. My house would be sorted. I would buy some linen trousers and go on mini breaks. And that's not what happens when you're middle aged, because you realise that when you were younger, you had the luxury of your problems being your problems. And when you get to middle age, your problems become other people's problems. Your parents are getting older, you have teenage children, your friends are getting divorced, and women are the ones who unpaid do this work and hold society together. And I wanted to write a book going, I can see you ladies, I see you, I pay tribute to you.
Yeah, because I thought that when we get to this age, and I'm around about the same age as you, I thought that we weren't supposed to care anymore what people thought, and we were supposed to be more chilled out, but it's not really the case, is it?
Well, I found in my more recent years, we sort of had a difficult couple of years. And since, as I write about in the book, my daughter was very ill, which at the end of that gave me such a huge amount of perspective when she got well again, that I am now, as I put it, in my hag years, where I really don't care now. And I stomp around wearing a cloak and go swimming in lakes and just sit around with my friends cackling like a witch.
Good, good. I like that. I like succumbing to tracksuits and stuff as we reach this age.
Claire Byrne and the Cozies on the radio. Not quite yet, but hey, it's early days. But Caitlin Moran talked about trying to help her daughter Nancy with her mental health difficulties.
One of the big things I realised with my daughter is that I was scared of sadness. You know, I'd always thought that it was great that I was, you know, cheerful and would move the conversation on and be bold and go-getting. But that's not useful if you're dealing with someone who is anxious and depressed. You need to, instead of jollying them out of it as I tried to, or rationalising it away to her in these huge TED Talks, you just need to sit with someone and go, you're sad. I'm so sorry. I'm not scared of your sadness. I'm going to stay with you.
And through the NHS, her daughter did eventually get the help she needed, but it led Moran to a wider exploration of that generation's anxiety.
Well, yeah, this is, I mean, I've seen it as a trope, and like, you know, I'm aware that I've done it myself, like kind of like when we're, you know, we generally would agree whatever side of the political spectrum we're at, that this isn't a great time at the moment for the world. Like, you know, there's a lot of intolerance. It's turned into sort of very binary groups, the environmental devastation, all this stuff, the economy's about to crash. And it's a very common trope for people of my age to go, oh, everything's really difficult at the moment. But the next generation, they're incredible. Look at Greta Thunberg and Emma Gonzalez. They know how to campaign. They're all together. The next generation are going to solve all this. They're incredible. And we say this to our kids, like, we might have screwed this up, but you guys are going to be amazing. And we think it's a compliment, but it's not, because what the kids are hearing is, mummy and daddy can't sort this out. You're going to have to do it. And, you know, to be telling teenagers who should really just be sort of concentrating on who they want to get off with and getting a bra that is comfortable, that they've also got to save the world and that we don't know how to do it, is absolutely terrifying. That is an existential abyss.
Mm-hmm. So we're saying to them, you solve the environmental problems, you solve the political problems, you solve the societal problems. We messed up and it's too late for us.
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of basically saying, wait till us and granddad and grandma are dead and then you'll inherit the world and you can sort it all out then. I mean, that's, I don't think we've ever had a generation before that's been raised with that kind of burden on its shoulders. Mm-hmm. And this one,
yeah, because that, I mean, if you think about it, that was never said to us.
No, I mean, we were a bit scared of the nuclear bomb, but we didn't think we had to sort it out. Like, someone else was going to have to sort it. I hope we weren't supposed to sort it out, because I definitely didn't. And this is why there's this mental health crisis now. One in four children will be diagnosed with depression, anxiety, eating disorders, or self-harm, and it's kind of our fault.
Ooh, Catelyn Moran with Claire Byrne on Thursday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It's time for Wednesday's Live Line, and gentle listener, be warned, they did a deep dive, quite the deep dive, into the world of onanism and general self-love. Now, it's quite early on a Saturday morning, so if you don't want to get into the sexual ins and outs of all of that, and it's quite possible you don't, you might want to give the next little bit a miss. So here's a short musical interlude to let you do just that. Either turn over or lean in. Okay then, if you're still with us, let's go. It all started with a package, a free package with a condom and a leaflet which advised on sexual activity in the time of COVID-19, and it was partly sponsored by the HSC. So in addition to hand washing, if you were really feeling the frustration, masturbation was to be considered. And if needs be, the somewhat ambiguously phrased remote sexual activity, for example, online, which could be interpreted as a particularly ripe Zoom call. Here's Bernie and then Sharon, or Cuddles versus the Colonel.
If it's Zoom online with a partner, how sad is that really? I feel very sad about it if it was me, because
well,
we're missing
sad,
out.
Is it? Oh,
hang on a second. You're missing out. If we're Zooming, we're missing out on the real intimacy, the affection, the sensuality, the cuddling, the holding. It's very, very, it's like dehumanising a person. I think that's really, really sad about the whole thing that's happening. It's very cold and calculating to
well,
have to do a Zoom
disagree.
Call.
You know, what if you're in a long-distance relationship and you physically can't touch
true,
the other person?
True.
Or if you're in isolation or, you know,
oh,
when
I know, but
it,
I'm just
on,
Sharon,
people
it's just,
couldn't
it's,
leave the house.
Absolutely. Then that's short-term. I'm talking about if this is coming to be long-term and people are getting used to it, it is quite sad, isn't it? That you're missing out. Okay, a long-term, I do get that. Even a long-term relationship, you're going to meet up. It's just the whole emphasis on Zooming online to have a relationship. I just think it's people are missing out on the whole, that whole affection, intimacy. And yes, I would, if I had a long-term relationship, of course you're going to do that. But don't advertise
it
as a long-term
thing.
It
doesn't have to be about intimacy and love. You know, you can have casual sex. People have casual sex all the time, you know, and that's
yes.
completely normal as well. So I think we need to teach young people that sex is very normal. It's fine
absolutely.
To have casual sex, and there doesn't always have to be, you know, with a long-term partner or, you know, things are changing, really.
It is probably...
I don't disagree with what you're saying.
Interesting discussion and quite a bit of common ground there. And then Anne phoned in, and for her, this online activity was a dog whistle for the unleashing of pornography.
Well, the thing that is shocking to me is that a message can be sent out as if it's the norm to get online and to substitute for the norm of sexual activity between young people, but to get it online. Now, that raises a point. It's going to go into the whole world of pornography, and it actually could break up already romances, because if a man or a woman gets into this world of watching pornography, the ordinary romance they have mightn't sort of live up to this wonderful world in their eyes of pornography. It's not exciting enough. So that you could have many romance broken up by getting involved. I think we have to really have very high standards for young people and to think that the virus could be responsible for this as well. I know it's hard on young people. We all know that. But it's not a toy. Sex is not a toy. The romance has to be there. And while it's hard on people, of course it is, they have to, like everybody else, little sacrifices have to be made.
But in terms of, you know, we know the issues around the virus is we have to try and keep away from other people in as much as possible. But surely then, you know, masturbation is the, if you need to be sexually satisfying yourself, the only way to do that is through masturbation.
Well, of course, different people would have different views on that. I think we've got
What's your view on that, Anne?
Well, my view would be to try and get away from the whole thinking of the sexual, if you like, appetite for people. They've got to, if you like, substitute, bring in, go in for sport, do all that kind of thing.
Oh, getting a little bit hot under the collar here on Playback and reaching for the runners. But then Kevin phoned in and it was a no from Kevin. You might even say a hard no.
Where do you stand on this?
Oh, I stand on it. I come to this from a Jesus Christ perspective. And that means that all this type of behaviour is totally and absolutely wrong. And matter how much those people come along and try to puff it up that this is the right thing to do and that the young people should be masturbating and all that type of thing, that's completely and absolutely wrong. And the other thing now
Katie,
the other thing is a male's semen is not stuff that is supposed to be flushed down the toilet or flushed down the drain or flushed anywhere. That is for the procreation, for people out there that don't know. That's what it's for. It's not for just, I feel like having a bit of sex at the minute. I masturbate myself, and just to keep me happy. Like, that's not the way. And people, if people never had sex in their life, never, it wouldn't kill them. They wouldn't die as a result, you know. It's not like the COVID. Sorry?
We'd all die out.
Yeah.
But
if no one ever had sex ever again, we'd all be extinct.
No, but all the people in the world don't have sex, you know.
Yeah, I know that.
Don't you be thinking that they all do, and the population hasn't run out. But I'm just saying, if people are feeling that they must have sex, or they'll die, they will not.
Sharon, Team Sodom and Gomorrah, to Kevin's Gilead. And that led Katie Hannan to a particularly delicate line of questioning.
Are you married, Kevin?
I am indeed, yeah. Yeah, I am married.
And did you save yourself for the wedding night?
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
And did you find that? Did you find that a challenge?
Not at all. No, I didn't, no.
What age were you when you got married, Kevin?
Some people do, I'm sure, and some people don't. But that's the thing.
What age were you when you got married?
Well, no, I don't. Does it really matter?
Well, if you got married very young, perhaps the challenge mightn't be as challenging as somebody who maybe walked down the aisle a bit later.
I was well through my 20s at the time, you know.
Right.
That cut out all teenage stuff and all that type of thing, wouldn't it?
It would.
Yeah, exactly. And it didn't come to me as a thing that I should go off and sleep with somebody or do anything like that. I never did until I slept with my wife. Like, that's the thing.
Kevin, that you'd be unusual in this regard?
No, of course I'm not unusual. There's nothing unusual about me. Anyone that knows me knows I'm not unusual. You know, I'm not. Well, of course I am to a point. I'm a one-off. There's only one of me in the world, you know. But apart from that, same as yourself, there's only one of you too, Katie. You
know. That's another thing God said.
Oh, how true. And for Kevin, his view was a matter of adherence to church teachings and his faith. And on that, he was holding firm.
There's nothing wrong with having sex, whether you're married or not, as long as everyone involved is an adult and they've given consent.
You see, who am I talking to there?
That's Sharon, Kevin.
Sharon, just to say to you, Sharon, there's always a payment day for these things. And people that do all this pornography and masturbating and all that sort of stuff, like, and having two wives and all this type of thing, that all has to be paid for. You know, you may think it's grand and fun and all at the
time. You don't have to pay to masturbate.
Sorry?
You don't have to pay to masturbate.
Yeah, hold on now, just let me finish the thing. The thing about it is that you do. You'll pay to the good Lord himself the day you close your eyes on this earth. That's when you'll pay for it. And I tell you one thing, if you ever heard tell of hell, you know, I'm sure you wouldn't like to end up in that.
Ooh, there's no right way to answer that one. That was Kevin. But last word on this to Katie Hannon.
It probably is better, though, if you can actually be in the same room as the person you're having sex with.
Liveline Wednesday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now for a bit of beauty. Johann Sebastian Bach there, which brings us nicely to conductor David Brophy, who spoke to Sean Rocks on Arena on Thursday night about how music, and live music in particular, is a necessity.
It's very difficult to stop making music when it's your job, and it's not even like it's your job. It's for musicians, it's not just their job, it's their life. It's they get up in the morning. It's like having a bowl of cornflakes. You get up in the day and you think music and play music and express yourself through music all day long. It's what you do. And when that stops, I mean, obviously a huge amount of musicians went online, and I realised quite quickly that that wasn't for me. That was one of my learnings, that I don't like listening to music so much through the speakers on my dreadful laptop, you know, because there's nothing like the real thing.
Yeah.
It's the fact that I love the fact that people are on stage holding bits of wood that were once growing in the ground, that were cut up into make violins and cellos, and they've got bits of string on them, and they've got horsehair that was running around a field at one stage, and they draw the hair, horsehair across the string, and the air around them vibrates, and that air that connects me to them then vibrates inside my ear, and the strange phenomenon is I can hear all the notes, the various notes, the scales that they play through my ear, and my brain can compute it. And by the way, this music is written by a guy who's dead 200 years ago. That for me is a great miracle that we all can enjoy on the planet, and it's been taken away from us, and the sooner we get back, the better.
Some of the pieces of wood might even be older than the pieces of music.
If you own a Stradivarius, or that certainly would have been from the early to middle parts of the 18th century, the music that, but even the brass instruments, the wind instruments, all the various artisans and people that go in to put the things together to make an orchestra. It's not just the 70 people on stage, it's all the instrument makers, it's all the humanity for centuries that went back to create these instruments that we have in front of us today. We are so lucky, and the sooner we get back and appreciate what we have in the arts, the better.
David Brophy with Sean Rocks on Arena. Wendy Moxley has walked from Malinhead to Mizzenhead to raise money for Women's Aid. Wendy had grown up in a violent home with an alcoholic father, which made her acutely aware of the vulnerability of other families in their houses during lockdown. And Wendy spoke to Ryan on Tuesday.
It was always there. It was always chaotic. You know, when my father walked into the house, you're walking on eggshells. You know, it was terrifying. You never knew. He was an alcoholic and a violent one, and so you never knew what was coming through the door. I mean, he could be great crack, but he could be vicious. He was kind of like a street angel, house devil, and you didn't know which one of those was going to come through the door. That threat was always in the house. You know, he could kick off at any stage, and you could hear the screams, the roaring, the beating at any time. I just remember one incident where he was locked out. It was small hours of the morning, I presume, we were all in bed asleep. And as I said, we lived above the pub, so he got a ladder up to the window of the room that I was sleeping in, and I was sleeping beside the window. And I heard knocking on the window, and I didn't know what it was. You know, at first I thought it was a bird, like a big crow or something. And I opened the curtain, and he was there, sort of saying, "Let me in, Wendy, let me in. Go on, go. Just open the window, there's a good car." And initially I kind of was terrified, said no, no, no. And eventually, of course, he got around me, and I opened the window and let him in. And then followed by screaming, crying, beating. It was terrifying. And then the guilt for doing that. And it still haunts me. I was about 7 or 8, I'd say, about that stage. But it was always going on. But at that particular incident, you know, I kind of pat you on the head when you came through the window. And then that is then immediately followed by the sounds of my mother screaming. And the sounds of thuds, you know, of her being beaten. So, and that guilt, that never leaves you.
Can you explain the guilt to me, please? What were you feeling guilty of or for?
And allowing him in, and allowing that to happen. And I know it's not. I know intelligently it's not my fault. Mm-hmm. But inside, you just feel as though if I hadn't let him in, that wouldn't have happened.
And for those who might think, well, why not just leave? Wendy spoke about the difficulty of escaping from such a toxic trap.
Society, as you say, kind of can not so much conspire, but don't know how to deal with it. Because if they approach it, it could make things 100 times worse for the victim. And the victim is afraid to do anything about it because it could make things 100 times worse. And often there isn't an outlet. You know, there isn't a way out. In my mother's case, I suppose, it was because he owned everything and church and society were just against breakups in any case, no matter what, for what reason.
He had control, didn't he? He controlled
complete control.
The household.
Complete control.
Yeah.
And she had 4 kids, where do you go?
Wendy Moxley with Ryan Tuberty, and Wendy is now raising money for Women's Aid. Malcolm McGann has just written a book called 32 Words for Field, Lost Words of the Irish Landscape. And Malcolm talked to Claire Byrne about growing up on a mix of Americana and Kerry.
So I was brought up in Donnybrook, and there in the 1970s, you have, you know, BBC on television, you have Montessori school, you have the Brady Bunch, John McEnroe. And then I'd go down for a quarter of the year out to the West Kerry Gaeltacht, where, like, the men were still bringing the milk churns across the Strand to the Uachtar and to the creamery in Riosk on the back of a horse and cart. And, you know, the Naoimh Óg, the men in Ballinasloe Pier were still, either the old men were watching the young men mending their nets and going out to sea. So that was a mindset that, you know, both were natural to me. Both the idea of what I was doing in Dublin, but I realised they were so different. Like this idea of the bahantiacht, the, you know, your time was spent, even as me, as a young person, I was spent just going from house to house. And it tended to be that the men were down, the old men were down at the pier, but the women were still at home. And a lot of these were ex-Blasket Island people who'd been moved to the mainland in the 50s. And so these women just were at home, and they loved the idea of having, or at least they put up with the idea of having some, you know, young 8-year-old Dublin boy coming across, because that was the way you called into people. And even like the amount of different words, you know, bahantiacht, obviously going from bahant to bahant, from house to house, but then there's scurriacht, which is like more of a gossiping visit to neighbours' houses. Or then there's Arnoil. Arnoil can mean a variety of things, but also it's a visit to other people's houses as long as singing and dancing in time. So it was just a mindset that was different. And my grandmother, who was this, she was Sheila Humphreys, this sort of Republican revolutionary, had a niece of the O'Rahilly, who founded the Volunteers, mm-hmm. was very involved in the beginnings of Conan na Gaeilge. So for them, the Irish language was key. It was a political tool, sort of to get our independence, to find our own psyche, our own way of looking at the world, but also to make sure that we fought for independence from Britain. And then they got it from my great, 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 was that four of them, granduncles, who was Aegon O'Rahilly, a poet in the 17th century, one of the last sort of embodiments of the old Gaelic school of bardic lore. And these last sort of professor poets of the old order were entitled to wear a cape of crimson feathers. So it was the ending ideas of this
fabulous
old Gaelic order. Yeah. And he was able to have a farab. And a farab was a dark satire, was when words had a physical effect on the world and they could raise a welt or a sort of a wound on your skin, it was believed, or on your face. So harsh was the potency, the power of the words.
But his grandmother's Irish was wielded as a weapon and Moncon was having none of it.
She was pretty rabid as a Republican, as a powerful fighter. And so during the early 80s, she would still have been supporting the hunger strikers and sending the comms, you know, which is little Rizla papers, these secret communications back and forth into the maze and the other prisons. And she would have had me helping her sort of translate these into Irish. And at some point, I was sort of a dyed-in-the-wool pacifist. I was just this little dreamy spiritual child, you know, who had my herb garden. And I realised if there's an agenda that this language is a sort of weapon, is a weapon of war, if every word I was meant to speak was almost aimed at England, or at least the English government, I moved away from that. And so I went off travelling. I just thought, I don't want to have anything to do with this. And I went off to Africa, went off to South America, went off to India for a few years. And it was actually in a place off Taiwan, a place called Lanyu Island, an island off Taiwan, where people lived underground at the time in these tunnels because hurricanes and tornadoes wipe out the island in winter. And there was this man, Shapen Mate Nan, and he only spoke his own language and, you know, was based on his culture. And he pulled out a dagger just to show me something, but he frightened me with this. I was frightened. And he looked into my eyes and he said, oh, he says, look, I didn't mean to frighten you. I was just going to show you our old ways. And he started singing a song of his own tradition. And just then I realised, God, we have our own tradition too. We, all of us, have this and we sort of cut off from it. We think of the Irish language as something to do with school or something to do with politics. But actually, it's this thing that roots us to the land. And that made me come back and immerse myself in
and,
Irish.
And that's why.
And Moncon is of the view if we could only relax a little around the Irish language, it would tell us so much about the land on which we live.
If we can have the trust to allow it rise up in us. So it has been so politicised. And so I suppose you could say that all those place names, those 50,000 or 70,000 place names in the landscape, in some way were a political act because we wanted Irish and English. But actually, each one of those place names is a portal, is a threshold to another way of seeing the land around us. And as I said, all of us do feel isolated from the land. It frightens us now that there's suddenly floods coming up or that the land is suddenly not as fertile. Most of that is encoded within those words. So if we choose each word, if we see each of those place names as a puzzle, a sort of a Zen koan, you know, a little poem that if unpacked will reveal things about what we were doing on that land, not only for 500 years, 1,000 years, but maybe 2,500 years, then it becomes a mystery, then it becomes a puzzle. And that needs to be done in school rather than thinking, need to start with the grammar, need to get over those challenging, you know, tenses.
Moncon began with Claire Byrne on his book, 32 Words for Field. Monday is D-Day for some 60,000 students who are going to be getting their Leaving Cert results. And on Sure It Was Better, they took us right back to 1993 and students from Our Lady's Bower in Athlone who were opening up their envelopes.
They didn't even put any economics on it.
What's she getting at?
Each girl picked up a plain envelope with a single sheet of paper. The marks are displayed in the style of a computer printout.
Joey! I got it. Jenny, I got a B1 in my German.
What's
I got a C, or B3, I think, or something. Yeah, B3 in my Irish.
I got a D.
For many students, the Leaving Cert now boils down to adding up points.
75 and 70 and 85.
Yeah, I'm sitting. Yeah, all
right. Where am I then? 70 again.
455, the exact same as me.
Brilliant. I did this.
You can't even lend me 10 points, would you?
And the panel of Pauline McGlynn, Emer McLeisett and Jules Call were still haunted by that exam and the moment of truth.
I've broken out in a cold sweat.
Me too.
Listening to that,
me
I just
too.
Feel I didn't do enough work, and even though my mocks weren't great, I didn't do enough work after that as well. Oh, it's.
I still have dreams terrible. About walking around my school, and I can remember every square inch of it. Yeah. Except I'm late for the exam, and I can't find the exam hall. Still dream about it. 20-something years later.
I don't think students are required. Definitely not required to go in and collect the results the way they used to these days.
Wasn't there something of an event though to go in and get your results and then be with everyone, you know, for the highs and the lows of it all. Yeah. So, I mean, getting it online, it lacks a certain va-va-voo.
It's different for this year's Leaving Certs though, isn't it? God, vastly different.
Oh, yes.
Vastly different is right, that was sure it was better. And on Tuesday, Minister for Education Norma Foley took a look across the water and decided that here, past academic performances of schools will not be used to standardise the Leaving Cert results. Anna O'Connor is a Leaving Cert student and she spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time. And Mary put it to her that this year, above all others, was a pretty stressful time to be doing the Leaving Cert.
Has it been a dreadful 5-6 months for you and your friends in Leaving Cert, as you first of all you had to be taken out of school in March, then you thought you were going to be sitting a Leaving Cert in July, then you were not sitting a Leaving Cert, then calculated grades, then controversy about calculated grades, and now finally today. I mean, there's been so many different changes and controversies along the way that must take a toll on you.
It's been exhausting. There has been a lot of tears from lots of us. I mean, it's just like the Leaving Cert is an awful year anyway, and I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of people are always like they want to get out of sitting the Leaving Cert, but by God, is there so much worse, because things just keep changing. And I mean, for a time there, some of my friends that want to go abroad for college thought that they were going to lose their places. Like, there's so much stress and so much worry, and we're so confused about what's happening. We have no idea what's going on. We have no idea when we'll even be able to start college. And we're just so ready for this to be over and just to get our grades and be able to put it behind us. I really want to study English in UCC, so I'm hoping everything will work out for me and I'll be able to go on, because I've been someone that's dreamed of college since I was in like primary school.
Anna O'Connor on Drive Time, and good luck to all Leaving Cert students on Monday. Never an easy exam at the best of times, but 2020, well, a year not to be forgotten. That's it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening, and if you're opening the envelope on Monday, this one's for you.
They say, oh my God, I see the way you shine. Take your hand, my dear, and place them both in mine. You know you stopped me dead while I was passing by, and now I beg to see you dance just one more time. Ooh, I see you, see you, see you every time. And oh my, I like your style. You make me wanna try, and now I beg to see you dance just one more time. So I say, dance for me, dance for me, dance for me, oh. I never seen anybody do the things you do before. They say, move for me, move for me, move for me, hey, hey. And when you're done, I'll make you do it all again. I said, oh my God, I see you walking by. Take my hands, my dear, and look me in my eyes. Do the things you do before.